Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. This past weekend, Tulsa Mayor G.T. Bynum issued a shelter-in-place order for all Tulsans due to the novel coronavirus pandemic. When we recorded today's show, as of 2 p.m. Sunday, there are now more than 700,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 worldwide, 135,000 of those here in the United States. No place has been more affected than New York City, with more than 50,000 cases, almost four times the next highest state, which is neighboring New Jersey. The number of deaths from COVID-19 continues to climb, with almost 2,500 in the U.S. and 33,000 across the world, and both numbers are climbing fast as new hotspots emerge. My guest today is in the center of it all, New York City. Dr. Danielle Ofri is an attending physician at the oldest public hospital in the United States, Bellevue. And as a general internist, a doctor who does primary care for adults, she's seen her world turn upside down. Her clinic is now silent, except for the phone calls she makes to her patients. She's now working in Bellevue's COVID tent, a large, white, open-flap tent in a courtyard at Bellevue that's been a triage and testing area for persons with suspected coronavirus infections. Ofri says that though the last 3 weeks feel like 3 months, every day is a new challenge, and she never knows what to expect or what she'll be asked to do next. We discussed the range of the pandemic in New York, the toll on healthcare workers, the need for more of them, in addition to personal protective equipment. Ofri is the editor of the Bellevue Literary Review and author of several books, including the forthcoming When We Do Harm, which will be out in a few weeks. Dr. Danielle Ofri, clinical professor of medicine at the New York University Grossman School of Medicine and attending physician at Bellevue Hospital, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Danielle Ofri, welcome back to Medical Monday. I just want to start by asking how you're doing.
Looking back, it's hard to believe it's only been 3 weeks. It feels like 3 years or 300 years. Honestly, every single day, every 2 days, our whole life changes. Our clinic is reconfigured, the hospital changes, our jobs are changing, we're moving different places, so it's just breathless. But I'm doing fine, thank you. I have amazing colleagues and wonderful people to work with, so we're doing okay, thank you.
You've written many wonderful op-eds for outlets, including the New York Times, and you had one in Sunday on March 20th or 21st, something like that. And so you have gone, you're an attending physician at Bellevue Hospital, you're a clinical professor of medicine at the NYU Grossman School of Medicine, but you normally practice primary care and just take care of people from all walks of life, but your regular clinic is totally different now. So I guess tell us what has changed.
What hasn't changed is what the question. So we're a huge clinic at Bellevue, and I think we have 500,000 outpatient and ambulatory visits a year. So our clinic came to a screeching halt. We turned it over, I said last week or 2 weeks ago, I can't even tell you, to everything by telephone, to not bring our patients physically into the hospital. So that's already one enormous thing. And then we started a site COVID testing, which we affectionately call the COVID clinic. And first we put that in a small geographically separated suite of offices on the ground floor, but that we just didn't have the capacity. So then we put up a tent in the courtyard of Bellevue, and that's been our place, the COVID tent, as it's affectionately called. And this adds a couple of advantages. One is we are geographically separate from the hospital itself, so we don't bring those patients in the hospital doors at all to prevent anyone from the hospital being infected by that. We also have more space, and then lastly, we have open sides of the tent, and so the airflow and decreases any kind of infectious risk, so it makes it much better from infection control. It does get a little chilly, and when it rains, it rains inside the tent too, but that's been the flow. Now, even that has changed because initially we were testing anyone with symptoms or who came in for a test. Then the Department of Health and CDC recommended to not do routine outpatient testing, and partly because at this point we're on the epidemic. Obviously, if we had unlimited tests, unlimited human power to do it, we want to test everyone for epidemiological purposes to screen and see where the asymptomatic carriers. That's how we'll know when we're cresting the epidemic. But given we don't have those two things, we really want to reserve the testing for inpatients and patients for whom the testing will make a difference. So for the average person who comes in and says, I've got a fever, a dry cough, and a little short of breath, they've got COVID till proven otherwise. And the truth is the test itself is not perfectly sensitive. So there are quite a few false negatives. That is, the person has the infection, but the test comes out negative. Knowing that, if a person has all the symptoms and we have a negative test, we're still going to treat them as though they have COVID, 14-day isolation, you know, that kind of thing. And so the test doesn't change our treatment. So we've actually stopped doing it, by and large, for those patients.
Wow. What is the triage? You mentioned if someone gets the test, whether or not it's positive, if they have symptoms, they'll be instructed to self-isolate. So, but I guess if they're more symptomatic, that is, seem to have even the slightest bit of shortness of breath, then they'll get triaged maybe into the hospital or into the emergency room?
So our other job is in triaging them by clinical acuity. So if someone is truly short of breath, now if someone is healthy without underlying conditions and is just a little mildly short of breath, we still send them home. We're trying our best not to admit patients unless they truly need to be. And again, because we don't want patients to go in the hospital necessarily, because you can catch COVID if you don't have it, you also can catch other things. We also, because the hospitals were slammed with very sick patients, we're really trying to keep those patients out. So really, we're looking for people who can't manage at home. So either the shortness of breath is severe and they're actually hypoxic, those patients obviously need oxygen and possibly intubation down the line, or patients with very fragile lung function or cardiac function for other reasons, for whom even a mild amount of shortness of breath could tip over their congestive heart failure, their emphysema, their other medical conditions. So those are the patients who, you know, we send to the emergency room, or maybe are too frail, not able to take care of themselves, or someone with similar symptoms might be able to ask family members. Those are the things we take into consideration when we triage clinically.
So, you know, we've been watching all the television reports out of New York, which really is the epicenter of the global pandemic at this point. And lots of reports of people in hospital, people on ventilators, people dying in New York City. So I guess from your vantage point, what are you hearing and seeing from colleagues or people in the critical care units, et cetera?
Well, the census, you know, just keeps going up and up. And so the hospital, we keep reconfiguring it. So one thing is, you know, in the last 10, 15 years, most hospitals have trimmed beds as a lot of medical care moves outpatient. So we had many wards at Bellevue that were turned into offices or educational suites. So we've been reactivating all those wards, you know, increasing hospital beds any place we can go, and then increasing ICU beds. And one way we've done that is by canceling all elective surgeries and all those operating rooms, those post-op units, ICUs, we cancel all elective colonoscopies, endoscopies. So those suites are all available. So those are becoming ICU beds for non-COVID patients to allow all our ICUs on one floor to make that entire floor a COVID ICU, and that's, you know, rapidly filling up, as well as the general medical patients. And we're trying very hard to cohort the patients geographically to put all COVID or COVID-suspected patients on certain wards and keep other patients with other diseases on other wards so they don't get infected. I mean, one thing about a pandemic is people don't stop having heart attacks or congestive heart failure, or diabetic ketoacidosis, and babies still come, kidney stones still come. So all that medical care, that's still going on. And one of our jobs is to keep those patients from getting COVID if at all possible. So there's lots of geographical and logistical moves that are going. We're also then pulling doctors from all over the place to help staff those wards. You know, the primary department that's been taking care of the epidemic so far has been the general medicine department, as it would make sense, and we have a lot of doctors, but we don't have enough for all this. We're pulling patient doctors from the outpatient, doctors from the specialties to come in. We've had a few folks from retirement come back, or those who've gone off to research fellowships have come back, so we're really pulling our crew from anywhere we can preemptively, and so far we've been able to handle that because we've been doing that so that any individual doctor is not so overloaded. You know, we're trying to keep burnout, you know, in mind, and trying to give people days off. And so we're all kinds of scheduling machinations to cover each other, give someone, you know, at least one day off on the week and maybe 3 weeks on, 1 week off, and it's all a moving target.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Danielle Ofri. She is a clinical professor of medicine at the NYU Grossman School of Medicine and attending physician at Bellevue Hospital in New York City, and is working I guess, daily in the COVID clinic. And you were just telling us Dr. Ofri about colleagues, about bringing people out of retirement and working to schedule shifts. I guess what's been the toll? You mentioned the sort of the emotional burden and the work hour burden, but have you colleagues of yours taken ill with COVID that you know of, or nurses in the hospital?
We do know some people have tested positive, and for reasons of privacy, those numbers aren't being, we do anecdotally have heard of it. I've heard of colleagues and some nurses and colleagues elsewhere, and when we get concerned, so far, everyone, knock on wood, has been doing well. But, I saw on Twitter the other day, an ER doctor posted that he had to intubate a colleague of his.
Oh,
and
my
heart sank, and we really, that could be where we go. Thankfully, we're not there yet, but one never knows. Most, doctors and nurses are pretty healthy people, but listen, they have medical conditions too. And we also know that COVID can affect very healthy people in a severe way. It's not common, but it's not uncommon either. And we saw that in Italy, we saw that in China. And so we're very worried about, keeping each other healthy and what happens when our colleagues become our patients. That could be a reality.
So what is your, I guess, daily or weekly schedule like? You're no longer working in the outpatient clinic as you once knew it. You're in this COVID tent, and there was a photograph of it in the New York Times. You actually sent some additional photographs, this beautiful magnolia tree. Like, who knew, I guess, if you're not familiar with Bellevue, that there's this big old courtyard with a magnolia tree in it where you could put up this tent. But are you there every day, or do you take a week on and a few days off or something? Or how is it working now?
Sure. We're alternating days. So some days I am back in the clinic, which is just sitting in my own lonely exam room calling patients. And other days, and I'm alternating with being in the tent. Just as you said, yes, it's quite incongruous that we're sitting in beautiful nature with a magnolia tree, a dogwood tree, a Calvary pear tree in the middle of New York City, and the tent sides are open, so you're really in touch with the weather. And the days that it's nice, it's lovely, and then when it was 40 degrees, it was freezing, and because it was raining, it's quite wet. So the tent is now shifting gears to try to offload the emergency room, and also to act as a walk-in or urgent care. People who are coming with symptoms who either don't call their doctors and just show up, or call their doctors and the doctors need to actually be seen by someone and they can't just be triaged over the phone. So in fact, Monday it's going to be a new iteration, and I'll see tomorrow when I get there where it'll be. So far it's been testing and then trying to offload the emergency room. Anyone's being, walkie-talkie, like they're doing pretty well and don't need to be seen in the emergency room. So trying to pull those patients off the ED. But, partly we think the messaging has gotten out to the public, don't come to the ER unless you're, really, really sick. So we're having fewer non-sick patients come in. So either they're very sick and have to get admitted, or they're not so sick and their doctors tell them to stay home. So every day it's changing. But when I go back to my clinic, which I do maybe every other day or every third day, it is very odd. It's very quiet in the clinic. Our normally incredibly bustling clinic is like a library now. And we're each in our rooms just calling our patients. And it's good to connect with them. Our patients are very anxious. And again, all their medical issues, they're still going on. They still have their diabetes and running out of medications and need refills. And people's depression and anxiety are getting heightened and provoked by all of this. There are patients who live alone and are very lonely or don't have good resources for getting food and toilet paper. So all of these issues, we're addressing on a daily basis.
On that issue about shortages, if you reach a patient and they say, I can't get this or I need this, or I suppose a medication would be the most obvious, but as you mentioned, toilet paper is, continues to, I guess, be in short supply in certain markets. Are there resources in New York City or with Bellevue, with health and hospitals that they're
yes,
able
absolutely.
To send people out? Yeah.
So we have a fantastic social work department, and, anyone who has any logistical struggle, I send an email to social workers, make them a phone with them, and hook them up with food pantries or senior visiting services. So we're aggressively working to help our patients with that. One challenge has been patients who come in from the shelter system who we think have COVID, and then we can't send them back to a congregate setting. That's been a challenge. I've had a number of patients at the tent with that, and how do we find a place for them where they can be in a single room with their own bathroom? Everyone's scrambling to find a place, and we're working on it, but sometimes it can be really hard because the size is so vast of how many patients have this need.
Wow. Well, I have to ask you, too, about personal protective equipment, because that's been such an ongoing issue throughout the pandemic, how seemingly unprepared we were in many healthcare enterprises across the United States. And, your governor, Andrew Cuomo, has been, I think, a leader in terms of trying to mobilize. I guess I've seen where the Javits Center, a huge convention center in New York City, is being commandeered to handle spillover or actually take patients who don't have COVID and can be offloaded from hospitals. But what's your sort of personal or your colleague's situation at Bellevue with regard to protective equipment?
So in terms of PPE, I mean, so far we appear to have enough, though we're using it very judiciously with the awareness that maybe 2 weeks we could run low. So we're using masks all day instead of, per patient, trying very hard to consolidate, on the inpatient side, who has to go into the room and how many times. So if a medication has to be given to a patient, it's a twice-a-day medication, that means the nurse has to gown up twice. Can we make it a once-a-day medication so the nurse has to enter once? And be really cognizant of every ordering you write, every medication you request, every service patient requires someone to gown up and certainly the gowns right now we're disposing of between patients because we don't want to spread germs from one to the next. So we haven't run out, but we're very aware that we could, and so we're being very careful. We'll have bags and they're labeling the masks and the face shields to reuse.
What's your personal ritual for, doffing, that is taking off the equipment, when you leave for home or go home? I mean, I've heard reports of doctors, or especially folks working in emergency rooms or intensive care units, who sort of either are sequestering themselves or taking off all their clothes right at the door and then jumping into the shower to sort of, at least feel like they're doing as much as they can to disinfect themselves and not bring germs home to their families. Do you have any ritual like that?
Well, in the tent, we share the roles of either assessing the patient, which is less involved, or you're doing the actual swab. So the day that I do the swabbing, when you're up close to people's noses all day, when I come home, I zip in, throw my clothes in the laundry, and jump into the shower. I think most people, I would say here in New York City, our apartments aren't so big enough for us to sequester ourselves and sleep elsewhere. But I know that people with, larger suburban houses, sometimes some doctors are sleeping, in separate rooms from their spouses and kids and using a separate bathroom. I mean, the truth is, before we leave, we wash our hands, wipe down our phones and anything we're carrying with us. And one advantage in the tent, at least because of the open air, it is a little less of an issue, but certain people who are in what we call the hot zones, the emergency room, the ICU, really do have to be very careful and wash down their shoes and all of that before they go home.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. We have a special edition here. We're talking to Dr. Danielle Ofri, who is a clinical professor of medicine at the New York University Grossman School of Medicine and an attending physician at Bellevue Hospital right in New York City, which is the world's has more cases of COVID-19 than any other place in the world right now. And Danielle Ofri, I wanted to know, I guess it's way too early to predict, and we've talked certainly about the uncertainty of the pandemic, and even how when you go to work in the morning, it's uncertain as to where you're going to be, essentially what your role is going to be that day. I just can't even imagine, coping with that. But you, in your op-ed in a couple Sundays ago, New York Times, you share with readers the story of how the spirit of people who work at Bellevue and the pride that, during Hurricane Sandy, I wasn't aware of this, people did a bucket brigade literally to try to really keep, the hospital from short-circuiting. Can you tell us about that story?
The generators are on the 13th floor of Bellevue. And, after we lost power, it became clear that the generator, it was the pumps in the basement that got flooded that usually they pump the fuel up to the 13th floor. And once the pump went down, then the generators would go down, within, 30 minutes, 60 minutes, something like that, some number of hours. And the people on, now we have, the ventilators do have batteries and powers, but they're not unlimited. And so people started a bucket brigade. Literally anyone on hand, doctors, nurses, orderlies, anyone, and just they passed them hand to hand up 13 flights and, got enough fuel up there. The National Guard finally came, and boy, those guys were fast. They could jog up with those big, 5-gallon things, but people were, passing up small things. And we've been to, you know, various iterations of crises. We had the Northeast blackout before that, when, you know, the whole Northeast went out. And you know, without any warning, there was that. We had 9/11. And for me, when I trained, we had HIV, which was more slow-moving, but incredibly taxing and dramatic in the way it affected our patients. And I have to say, for each one of these, although they're very anxiety-provoking, it just makes me so grateful for where I work. I mean, I feel so fortunate to work with such an incredible group of people. Every day we meet, we have our COVID meeting, and the group is energetic and focused and determined, and no shortage of volunteers. It's I'll say invigorating in quotes. Like, it's not a fun thing, but it feels good that people are moving. And I recognize that for many people, the pandemic is sitting at home and feeling isolated and feeling powerless, and how frustrating that is and painful. Many of my patients are feeling that. In some ways, we get spared that because we have something to do. We get to go out of the house every day and do something. It's not always pleasant. It can be a little disturbing in the global sense, but in the day-to-day, moment-to-moment sense, it's really moving forward. And partly that lets you be, not to put blinders on, but you can close your eyes to the bigger epidemic and just focus on, okay, here's today what I got to do. I have a list of 20 things to do, and that keeps you focused. And I'll say it's only when you're home at night trying to go to sleep, when you really think about the big picture. And on Thursday, I had my first social distancing dream where I couldn't get out of the crowd on the streets of New York City, and it felt like a nightmare. So it really comes home, I think, when we're home alone and really having a chance to sort of look at this in the big picture, that, you know, boy, this could really change our life as we know it.
Wow. Well, I guess it's obviously way too early to predict, but you're such a reflective person and have written so much. And also, I think you're the editor, I believe, of the Bellevue Literary Review and author of several books. But I wonder what you think may last in terms of how we've changed practice. For example, we talked about telephoning patients or telemedicine. Do you think that'll be something that sticks around, or do you think we'll go back to more in-person contact with our patients when this, if it ever subsides?
Well, I think we'll certainly go back to in-person contact, and we really need that. But, you know, telephone visits can really serve a great purpose, and part of it is getting insurance to reimburse for that. Once you're willing to reimburse for that, then we can use it for patients who can't get to the hospital. You might have a number of homebound patients who come very rarely. I call them all the time. My hospital never gets reimbursed or paid for that work, and so it would be very nice if that could be considered legitimate medicine. So I think telemedicine will be more legitimized, you know, going forward, and we'll have some kind of combination of maybe, you know, one visit in person and one visit is by telephone. What I hope really sticks is the recognition that planning ahead is so important. And you know, I think about the CDC offices that were working abroad, you know, after the Ebola epidemic to help control epidemics abroad, and how that office was defunded and disbanded. And that lack of foresight, we're really paying the price for that. So, you know, public health is a constant process. During the economic crisis from 10 years ago, many local departments of health lost significant portions of their budgets. And when we recovered economically, those budgets were never restored. So those health departments were short-staffed. And that's, you know, it's just poor medicine. You know, we need to keep those, you know, all the time. Even when things seem good, we always have to be on the lookout. So when it happens, and we saw, I think, with this epidemic, unlike HIV and even Ebola, how fast it could happen. And having these mechanisms in place is critical.
So, Dr. Ofri, I know you're a cellist, and I've seen on social media going around these Yo-Yo Ma performances trying to keep people's spirits up. I was wondering if throughout all this you've had a chance to kind of play your cello or get out or share other musical interludes with other musically inclined folks, whether they be medical or otherwise?
Well, cello, for things overstating the case, but I take cello lessons. And so I switched to Skype for my lessons. And I'm trying most nights to play because it just keeps my same routine. And the nice thing about music, especially when you're trying to play, is your focus is incredibly inward and focused on a single note or a single measure or a phrase. And then you get to worry. But the most important thing is just to sound beautiful. And, you know, during those days in the hospital, we're not thinking much about beauty and aesthetics and art. And so it's good to kind of flip your brain and your focus a bit to be on the beauty. And someone did send me Yo-Yo Ma's people who played the Sarabands and Third Cello Suite and who dedicated it to healthcare workers. And for me, I just graduated this year from the Third Suite, and so hearing it, and I haven't heard it in a year because I'm working on the fourth, it was like having an old friend come back and just kind of put their arm around your shoulder and give you a pat, a very familiar hug. And I really appreciate it. So I wrote Mr. Ma a letter just thanking him for putting the Sarabande of Bach's Third Cello Suite up for the world.
That's so nice. It'll be interesting to see if you get a response. I want to ask one last question. You have a book that's due to come out, I think, in a couple of weeks. Your latest book, it's called When We Do Harm, and I was hoping to interview you for the program, but to the extent that you're willing to at least let the cat out of the bag a little bit and do some early commentary. So I'm guessing this is a book about medical error and how to sort of handle it, frame it, talk to patients about it?
Yes, so it's about medical error and the larger issue of patient safety. There was a paper a few years back that cited medical error as the third leading cause of death in the U.S. And I was really, wondering about, is that really true or not? And that became the inspiration to start this examination, whether that's a true statement. And if it is true, then we seem not to be seeing it. And if it's not true, then why is that? And it was interesting, is with this epidemic, it makes me think a lot about patient safety and medical error. Partly we're changing protocols so quickly. Every day the protocol is different, and it's easy to let your guard down. We were, for example, initially for the COVID clinic, if a family came together, we put each patient in a different room and interviewed separately. But we ran out of room to start cohorting families, so then I'd have to interview, the whole family together. But each person has a separate medical chart. Now, it's keeping three charts open, and that's really dangerous. That's set up for medical error. So trying to keep in mind, even though we're rushing and changing to adapt, that we have to, be cognizant of medical error. So as it stands, I hope the book will come out on time. I think it will. But, we hear lots of stories about errors in hospitals, and so much of it, though, comes down to how we communicate. And a lot of lawsuits and medical errors focus on or boil down to errors in communication. So one big push of the book is looking at how we speak to each other as clinicians, how doctors and patients speak, and where we can, help minimize medical error in that respect.
Well, I'm definitely looking forward to that book coming out, and it's one of the many casualties is, I guess, the book tour you were hoping to do. I know you do a lot of public speaking and speaking at medical schools or grand rounds. So hopefully, if and when the COVID pandemic subsides, we'll be able to resume that part of our lives. It's travel
sure
is really,
so.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Danielle Ofri, it's been so great to talk to you. I'm so glad to hear that you're coping with this and doing well. I wish nothing but the best for you and your family and hope you stay safe.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it so much.
Dr. Danielle Ofri is a clinical professor of medicine at the NYU Grossman School of Medicine in New York City. She's also an attending physician at Bellevue Hospital there. Her op-ed titled Why Doctors and Nurses Are Anxious and Angry appeared in the March 22nd edition of the Sunday New York Times, and we'll link to it on our website. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and stay safe.